So welcome to our last evening reading the pages of the Life Divine together. Chapter 28, The Divine Life. We conclude tonight. He was describing that a Gnostic consciousness is a truth power in action that harmonizes the context in which it works. So can forcefully, harmoniously, successfully shape according to its will the nature in which it lives, bringing even the ignorance up into the light more and more, so that the boundaries which constrict the ignorant view begin to recede, become malleable. We don't then live in hard divisions if we are ensconced in ignorance. The presence of a truth light, in a sense, unlocks the doors of the prison. It is then up to us, in the balance of ignorant nature, to simply push the door open and to come out and to grow. So we continue these last few pages. All life for the achieved spiritual or Gnostic consciousness must be the manifestation of the realized truth of spirit. I'll read that again. But note the words, all life. The master word of the synthesis of yoga is, all life is yoga. All life for the achieved spiritual or Gnostic consciousness must be the manifestation of the realized truth of spirit. Only what can transform itself and find its own spiritual self in that greater truth and fuse itself into its harmony can be accorded a life acceptance. What will so survive, the mind cannot determine. For the supramental gnosis will itself bring down its own truth, and that truth will take up whatever of itself has been put forth in our ideals and realizations of mind and life and body. The forms it has taken there may not survive, for they are not likely to be suitable without change or replacement in the new existence. But what is real and abiding in them, or even in their forms, will undergo the transformation necessary for survival. So in framing what is a Gnostic life, he is saying that the spiritual realization is a necessary and prior status that we must achieve in advance of the transformation. And then, as the spiritual power proceeds into nature, the forms that would hold that power, that brilliance, must be new shaped so that they are accommodating to that which would install itself in the earthly presence. Much that is normal to human life would disappear in the light of gnosis. The many mental idols, constructed principles and systems, conflicting ideals which man has created in all domains of his mind and life, could command no acceptance or reverence. Only the truth, if any, which these specious images conceal, could have a chance of entry as elements of a harmony founded on a much wider basis. It is evident that in a life governed by the Gnostic consciousness, war, with its spirit of antagonism and enmity, its brutality, destruction, and ignorant violence, political strife, with its perpetual conflict, frequent oppression, dishonesties, turpitudes, selfish interests, its ignorance, ineptitude, and muddle could have no ground for existence. Turpitude means baseness, vileness, depravity. The arts and the crafts would exist, not for any inferior mental or vital amusement, entertainment of leisure and relieving excitement or pleasure, but as expressions and means of the truth of the spirit and the beauty and delight of existence. Life and the body would be no longer tyrannous masters demanding 9/10 of existence for their satisfaction, but means and powers for the expression of the spirit. At the same time, since matter and the body are accepted, the control and the right use of physical things would be a part of the realized life of the spirit in the manifestation in earth nature. So you can see him advancing from the top of the paragraph to the bottom, going again through mind, life, the aesthetic richness that comes with the manifestation, what it means for the physical life, and what he's put in that final sentence, since matter and body are accepted, is contra all the traditions of renunciation that we assign to spirituality. For Sri Aurobindo, these are not to be rejected, but illuminated, ridded of their elements of ignorance, brought forward in beautiful form for the joy of life, for the brilliance in the mind, for the satisfaction that the body feels being an apt and plastic vehicle to carry these treasures of the spirit forward. It is almost universally supposed that spiritual life must necessarily be a life of ascetic spareness, a pushing away of all that is not absolutely needed for the bare maintenance of the body. And this is valid for a spiritual life, which is in its nature and intention a life of withdrawal from life. But that's only one brand of spirituality. Even apart from that ideal, it might be thought that the spiritual turn must always make for an extreme simplicity, because all else would be a life of vital desire and physical self-indulgence. But from a wider standpoint, this is a mental standard based on the law of the ignorance, of which desire is the motive. To overcome the ignorance, to delete the ego, a total rejection not only of desire but of all the things that can satisfy desire, may intervene as a valid principle. So that kind of spirituality is a way station along the way, but not the last evolute of spiritual possibility. But this standard, or any mental standard, cannot be absolute, nor can it be binding as a law on the consciousness that has risen above desire. A complete purity and self-mastery would be in the very grain of its nature, and that would remain the same in poverty or in riches, for If it could be shaken or sullied by either, it would not be real and would not be complete. Now this goes back, does it not, to a chapter in Sri Aurobindo's seminal little book, The Mother, about the nature of the money force, of what is the power of prosperity in life. And now he gets to the pith. The one rule of the Gnostic life would be the self-expression of the spirit, the will of the divine being. That will, that self-expression, could manifest through extreme simplicity or through extreme complexity and opulence, or in their natural balance. For beauty and plenitude, a hidden sweetness and laughter in things, a sunshine and gladness of life, are also powers and expressions of the spirit. And he hints here at the ananda, which is the ultimate reason for the manifestation, noted in the Taittiriya Upanishad centuries and centuries and centuries ago. In all directions, the spirit within, determining the law of the nature, would determine the frame of the life and its detail and circumstance. In all, there would be the same plastic principle, a rigid standardization, however necessary for the mind's arrangement of things, could not be the law of the spiritual life. A great diversity and liberty of self-expression based on an underlying unity might well become manifest, but everywhere there would be harmony and truth of order. A life of Gnostic beings, carrying the evolution to a higher supramental status, might fitly be characterized as a divine life. For it would be a life in the divine, a life of the beginnings of a spiritual divine light and power and joy manifested in material nature. So you see, he distinguishes between Gnostic beings who are illuminated by the higher planes of consciousness, reaching up into the supramental, from supramental status itself established here. So a supramental being is something a notch beyond, so to say, a Gnostic being. That might be described, since it surpasses the mental human level, as a life of spiritual and supramental supermanhood. But this must not be confused with past and present ideas of supermanhood. Nietzsche. For supermanhood in the mental idea consists of an overtopping of the normal human level, not in kind, but in degree of the same kind, by an enlarged personality, a magnified and exaggerated ego, an increased power of mind, an increased power of vital force, a refined or dense and massive exaggeration of the forces of the human ignorance. It carries also, commonly implied in it, the idea of a forceful domination over humanity by the Superman. That would mean a supermanhood of the Nietzschean type. It might be, at its worst, the reign of the blonde beast or the dark beast, or of any and every beast, a return to barbaric strength and ruthlessness and force. But this would be no evolution. It would be a reversion to an old strenuous barbarism. We have to say more about this, but obviously the referent point is World War II and the active manifestation of the Nazi philosophy, could we call it? Sri Aurobindo, writing in 1939 and 1940 to publish these volumes of The Life Divine. The war is on. It is no longer a potentiality. It is now an actuality. And Sri Aurobindo addresses it in these paragraphs, in these lines. Strenuous barbarism. Or it might signify the emergence of the Rakshasa or Asura out of a tense effort of humanity to surpass and transcend itself, but in the wrong direction. What is interesting, as a side note, is that Hitler was regarded as a Rakshasa, Stalin as an Asura, and the fell combination of both of them together took a sort of divine art to divide and conquer and separate them so that humanity could continue to advance in the upward course of evolution. So look carefully at how he describes this, because this also can be matched up back to the Bhagavad Gita, where it describes the difference between the various types. A violent and turbulent, exaggerated vital ego, satisfying itself with the supreme tyrannous or anarchic strength of self-fulfillment, would be the type of a Rakshasic supermanhood. But the giant, the ogre, or devourer of the world, the Rakshasa, although he still survives, belongs in spirit to the past. A larger emergence of that type would be also a retrograde evolution. A mighty exhibition of an overpowering force, a self-possessed, self-held, even it may be, an ascetically self-restrained mind capacity and life power, strong, calm, or cold, or formidable in collected vehemence, subtle, dominating, a sublimation at once of the mental and vital ego, is the type of the Asura. So he's described the Rakshasa and the Asura. But Earth has had enough of this kind in her past, and its repetition can only prolong the old lines. She can get no true profit for her future, no power of self-exceeding from the Titan, the Asura. Even a greater supernormal power in it could only carry her on larger circles of her old orbit. Because both Rakshasa and Asura belong primarily to the vital domain. The Rakshasa, the twisted part of the mid-vital. The Asura, the twisted part of the higher vital, reaching towards the mind. More clever, a little less base than the Rakshasa, a little less bloody, but still seeking for the affirmation of ego, that loud, blatant ego. But what has to emerge is something much more difficult and much more simple. It is a self-realized being, a building of the spiritual self, an intensity and urge of the soul, and the deliverance and sovereignty of its light and power and beauty. Not an egoistic supermanhood seizing on a mental and vital domination over humanity, but the sovereignty of the spirit over its own instruments, its possession of itself and its possession of life in the power of the spirit, a new consciousness in which humanity itself shall find its own self-exceeding and self-fulfillment by the revelation of the divinity that is striving for birth within it. So, implicitly, the approach of this supramental possibility, the approach of a greater light, calls forth, summons up the powers of darkness, who must be confronted, who must be calmed, harmonized, made less ignorant, disarmed, as it were. So the danger to us is that alluring cry to their exhibition of power might be seductive. We must not be seduced. We must cleave to the light. Cling to truth, as Mother said. So this dynamic, expansive expression of self-realization. Again. But what has to emerge is something much more difficult and much more simple. It is a self-realized being. First step, to know the truth of your own being inside, to live from the soul, to live in the larger spirit around. That's the first step. A building of the spiritual self. That means actively bringing the spiritual power and the psychic power, the efflorescence of the soul, into all the values of life. An intensity and urge of the soul and the deliverance and sovereignty of its light and power and beauty. Not an egoistic supermanhood, seizing on a mental and vital domination over humanity, but the sovereignty of the spirit over its own instruments, its possession of itself, and its possession of life in the power of the Spirit, a new consciousness in which humanity itself shall find its own self-exceeding and self-fulfillment by the revelation of the divinity that is striving for birth within it. It's worth reading again. It's an evocation of all the hidden truths of our nature that is coming forward. It is the claim of this conquering consciousness force, of that which it earlier manifested, is saying, come home to me, be mine, we shall together establish truth here. And the satisfaction that you missed before, I shall lay into your hands. So this is expressive of a yogic attainment, affecting a change in life as the evolutionary bridge. So if this is going to happen on Earth, those who practice yoga have to enlarge the prospect of what they're working on and aim not only at the discovery of the spiritual reality or the perfection of the body, but bring those two things together, to marry spirit to body. This, he writes, is the sole true supermanhood, and the one real possibility of a step forward in evolutionary nature. The one real possibility. So, you're so important. Your work on yourself. Your work in context with others. It's invaluable, and thank you for your service. Thank you for your commitment. Thank you for carrying this forward to the true attainment. This new status would indeed be a reversal of the present law of human consciousness and life, for it would reverse the whole principle of the life of the ignorance. It is for the taste of the ignorance, its surprise and adventure, one might say, that the soul has descended into the inconscience and assumed the disguise of matter, for the adventure and the joy of creation and discovery, an adventure of the spirit, an adventure of the mind and life, and the hazardous surprises of their working in matter, for the discovery and conquest of the new and the unknown. All this constitutes the enterprise of life, and all this, it might seem, would cease with the cessation of the ignorance. Man's life is made up of the light and the darkness, the gains and losses, the difficulties and dangers, the pleasures and pains of the ignorance, a play of colors moving on a soil of the general neutrality of matter, which has as its basis the nescience and insensibility of the inconscient. To the normal life being, an existence without the reactions of success and frustration, vital joy and grief, peril and passion, pleasure and pain, the vicissitudes and uncertainties of fate and struggle and battle and endeavor, a joy of novelty and surprise and creation projecting itself into the unknown, might seem to be void of variety and therefore void of vital savor. In other words, if we don't have darkness, how can we appreciate light? Any life surpassing these things tends to appear to it as something featureless and empty, or cast in the figure of an immutable sameness. The human mind's picture of heaven is the incessant repetition of an eternal monotone. But this is a misconception. For an entry into the Gnostic consciousness would be an entry into the infinite. It would be a self-creation, bringing out the infinite infinitely into form of being. And the interest of the infinite is much greater and multitudinous, as well as more imperishably delightful than the interest of the finite. The evolution in the knowledge would be a more beautiful and glorious manifestation, with more vistas ever unfolding themselves, and more intensive in all ways than any evolution could be in the ignorance. The delight of the spirit is ever new. The forms of beauty it takes innumerable, its Godhead ever young, and the taste of delight, rasa, of the infinite, eternal and inexhaustible. So rather than the struggle between light and dark, from light to greater light, from delight to greater delight, without the need of a dark, delimiting contrast. Delight, ananda. The Gnostic manifestation of life would be more full and fruitful, and its interest more vivid than the creative interest of the ignorance. It would be a greater and happier constant miracle. Now remember, Sri Aurobindo was a classicist. He knew Latin and Greek to utter perfection. He chose the term miracle to end that sentence. Miracle in Latin, miraculum, means to wonder at. It isn't an irrational miracle suddenly thrust upon, but it's a wonderment. It is the manifesting of a new strand of the infinite that stands forth as a miracle. If there is an evolution in material nature, and if it is an evolution of being with consciousness and life as its two key terms and powers, this fullness of being, fullness of consciousness, fullness of life, must be the goal of development towards which we are tending and which will manifest at an early or later stage of our destiny. The self, the spirit, the reality that is disclosing itself out of the first inconscience of life and matter, would evolve its complete truth of being and consciousness in that life and matter. It would return to itself, or if its end as an individual is to return into its absolute, it could make that return also. Not through a frustration of life, but through a spiritual completeness of itself in life. Our evolution in the ignorance, with its checkered joy and pain of self-discovery and world discovery, its half-fulfillments, its constant finding and missing, is only our first state. It must lead inevitably towards an evolution in the knowledge, a self-finding and self-unfolding of the spirit, a self-revelation of the divinity in things, in that true power of itself in nature, which is to us still a supernature. The end. This calling forth of the evolution of Satchit-Ananda hidden in nature to its ultimate self-disclosure as a supernature. He echoes what he wrote in the first chapter, The Human Aspiration. It manifests itself in the divination of Godhead, the impulse towards perfection, the search after pure truth and unmixed bliss, the sense of a secret immortality. And later, calling us back to the secret, for all problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony, inviting us to a progressive self-enlargement, as he writes here, a self-finding and self-unfolding. So the life divine was begun at the outset of World War I. And here, at the beginning of World War II, he comes forward with a revised, enlarged, but still positive and felicitous view of the future role that humanity can make as a bridge leading towards a life divine. So, the 15th is in the middle of this week, Sri Aurobindo's birthday. A week from today on Sunday, I would like to linger over the life divine, and you can all join. Everyone is welcome to come on Zoom and in our little room here. And let's touch upon the major themes, the motifs, which run through the warp and the woof of this magnum opus of Sri Aurobindo. Let's get together and spend 45 minutes or so and summarize what his message is here. We won't get into the labyrinthine arguments of the nature of being, etc. I won't suffer upon you with logic. But let's get together and do this again. I mentioned the book, The Mother, as it resonated with one of the last paragraphs. That will be our next study after the life divine. We'll take up the mother. But tonight, again, from so many passages which could be read to close out our evening together and our reading of the Life Divine, I'm going to turn to Book 11, the Book of Everlasting Day, the Soul's Choice and the Supreme Consummation. Awake to his hidden possibility. Awake to all that slept within his heart, and all that nature meant when earth was formed, and the spirit made this ignorant world his home. He shall aspire to truth and God and bliss. Interpreter of a diviner law, and instrument of a supreme design, the higher kind shall lean to lift up man. Man shall desire to climb to his own heights. The truth above shall wake another truth, even the dumb earth become a sentient force. The spirit's tops and nature's base shall draw near to the secret of their separate truth and know each other as one deity. The spirit shall look out through matter's gaze, and matter shall reveal the spirit's face. Then man and Superman shall be at one, and all the earth become a single life. Even the multitude shall hear the voice and turn to commune with the spirit within and strive to obey the high spiritual law. This earth shall stir with impulses sublime. Humanity awake to deepest self, nature, the hidden Godhead recognize. Even the many shall some answer make and bear the splendor of the divine's rush and his impetuous knock at unseen doors. A heavenlier passion shall upheave men's lives. Their mind shall share in the ineffable gleam. Their heart shall feel the ecstasy and the fire. Earth's bodies shall be conscious of a soul. Mortality's bondslaves shall unloose their bonds. Mere men into spiritual beings grow and see awake the dumb divinity. Intuitive beams shall touch the nature's peaks. A revelation stir the nature's depths. The truth shall be the leader of their lives. Truth shall dictate their thought and speech and act. They shall feel themselves lifted nearer to the sky, as if a little lower than the gods. For knowledge shall pour down in radiant streams, and even darkened mind quiver with new life and kindle and burn with the ideal's fire and turn to escape from mortal ignorance. The frontiers of the ignorance shall recede. More and more souls shall enter into light, minds lit, inspired, the occult summoner hear, and lives blaze with a sudden inner flame, and hearts grow enamored of divine delight, and human wills tune to the divine will. These separate selves the spirit's oneness feel. These senses of heavenly sense grow capable. The flesh and nerves of a strange ethereal joy, and mortal bodies of immortality. A divine force shall flow through tissue and cell, and take the charge of breath and speech and act, and all the thoughts shall be a glow of suns, and every feeling a celestial thrill. often a lustrous inner dawn shall come, lighting the chambers of the slumbering mind. A sudden bliss shall run through every limb, and nature with a mightier presence fill. Thus shall the earth open to divinity, and common natures feel the wide uplift, illumine common acts with the Spirit's ray, and meet the deity in common things. Nature shall live to manifest secret God. The Spirit shall take up the human play. This earthly life become the life divine. And as we finish reading, rain comes, a sign of Mother's grace. Namaste, Jai Ma. I salute you. Salutations all for completing this long journey.